Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio, brought to you by the OU Israel Center in Jerusalem. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this week's show is for Parshat Vayetze. If you are listening to this show, it's either on www.israelnationalradio.com, in which case its first broadcast is 5 p.m. on Thursday, Israel time. It's repeated at 11, and then again a couple of times on Friday. It is also available on Audio On Demand by clicking any time after it's posted. You could also be listening on www.ouradio.org, or radiouradio.org. Those are two identical websites that carry the OU's new internet radio station. You have Daf Yomi and many, many interesting programs. So too, of course, there are interesting programs on Israel National Radio. Take your pick, OU Radio or Israel National Radio. There's a slight difference, maybe more than slight, between the two versions of Torah Tidbits Audio. The one on Israel National Radio is locked into very fixed time frame, 23 minutes the first half, first part, 26 minutes the second part. When I mix the two halves for OU Radio, I have the luxury of adding things at the end that I don't have time for in the Israel National Radio broadcast, which means there are extra Divrei Torah and sometimes an extra song. So basically, take your pick how you want to listen to Torah Tidbits Audio, and if you tell anyone else about it, just know that it's available both on the OU internet radio site, www.ouraidio.org, or at www.israelnationalradio.com. With a terrorist attack, a pigua earlier this week, with a Qassam rocket that was fired over this past night, with the political situation so messy here in Israel, we still are saying Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed, and it's certainly not out of place. I hope everyone appreciates the opportunity to put in this prayer. Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Karaticha Adonai. Adonai Shema V'koli Tihiyena Aznecha Kashuvot L'kol Tachanunai. Imavonot Tishmorya Adonai Miya Amod. Ki Imacha Hasalicha L'ma'an Tivarei. Ki Viti Adonai Kiveta Nafshi V'lidvaro Hocholti. Nafshi L'Adonai Mi Shomerim L'Boker Shomerim L'Boker. Yachel Yisrael El Adonai Ki Im Adonai HaChesed V'harbe Imo Fedut. Vehu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanatunim batzara uvashivya, haomedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, hamakom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha, umeyafela laora umishibud lugeula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv, v'nomar amen. Last Shabbat I heard an interesting short Dvar Torah, which I think puts the whole parsha and the story of Vayetze into a certain perspective. In speculating why Yitzchak had even the Hava Amina, the first thought of giving the special blessing to his son Esav rather than to Yaakov, ultimately Yaakov got it. Ultimately, we accept the notion that Yaakov was the deserving recipient of the blessing, but Yitzchak thought of giving it to Esav and not to Yaakov, and the question is why. Of many possible answers, this is one that I heard in the name of Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Pupko, who explained like this. Yitzchak was concerned that the blessing should go to the true heir of Avraham Avinu, not just as far as lineage is concerned, but the person whose personality might produce another Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu is credited with going out into the world and bringing the word of one God to the people. Yaakov Avinu was, as the Torah described him, an ish tam yoshev ohalim, a simple, straightforward person, one who dwelled in the tents, the connotation meaning within the four walls of the Torah study world. It is what's known as the Yeshiva of Shem and Aver. And as such, Yitzchak saw in him a budding Talmud Chacham, no doubt, but he wasn't so sure if Yaakov would be the one to bring Avraham's message out into the world. Esav, on the other hand, was an Ish Sadeh, a man of the field, an outgoing person who would come into contact with people. And Yitzchak perhaps saw in Esav the potential of carrying the word of Avraham, Yitzchak, etc. to the world. So at the end of Parshat Toledot, when Yitzchak is sending Yaakov out into the world, he gives him the bracha of Avraham, perhaps knowing that he is the type to bring that further to other people and to be able to maintain the level of his belief and practice, not just in the four walls of the Yoshev Ohalim of the Yeshiva, but also be able to bring it to the world. Apropos that, there's an interesting comment by one of the commentaries on Rambam in Mishneh Torah Hilchot Avodah Zarah, the Laws of Idolatry. Rambam atypically begins the Laws of Idolatry with an introduction. If you look in many, many other sections of Rambam's work, you won't find introduction. He plunges right in to the mitzvot asei and the mitzvot lo tasei, the positive and negative mitzvot that are being treated in that section. But in idolatry, he introduces it with a brief history of the genesis of idolatry, and he attributes it beginning in the third generation of the world to the generation of Enosh, grandson of Adam Harishon. He said in his time, in the time of Enosh, people made a teensy-weensy error. They said, not only do we have to worship God, but we should also worship and venerate those creations of gods that are much more powerful than we are. And the sun, S-U-N, became an object of worship, originally not as something that took away from the worship of God, but something that was reasoned, wrongly so, to be in line with how we are supposed to revere God himself. Anyway, the Rambam continues through successive generations. It got worse and worse and became a totally polytheistic kind of society until, and this is the point that I am relating this, until Avraham Avinu, who reintroduced the world to monotheism, to belief in one God. One of the commentaries asks, well, wait a minute, there were people before Avraham who also spread the word of one God, who taught the word of one God, and his examples are Shem, son of Noach, and Aver, a great-great-grandson of Noach. So how come, he asks, is Avraham Avinu given credit for the one to reintroduce monotheism by the Rambam in his introduction to the Laws of Idolatry? His answer is, because Shem and Aver stayed in the proverbial four walls of the yeshiva, and people who came to them were taught belief in one God, but Avraham Avinu went out into the world, put his tent in such a position that travelers would stop for some of his home hospitality and Sarah's wonderful cooking or whatever, and he would teach them belief in one God. That is the kind of person who gets the credit for introducing mankind or reintroducing mankind to monotheism, not the one who stays in the Dalet Amot of the yeshiva and waits for people to come to him and say, teach me something. Be that as it may, as the expression goes, Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva Vayelech Charana, Yaakov left Be'er Sheva, left Eretz Yisrael, left his father's home, left the four walls of the yeshiva and went to Haran, a place filled with challenges, let's say, which he handled very well. We'll get back to Vayetze in a moment. I just want to play a song and tie it in somewhat to something that I said earlier. A couple of days back, when there was the bombing in Netanya, I heard about it shortly before we davened Mincha here at the Israel Center. Every day at Mincha we say Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed, because of the Matzav. On that day, because of the Pigua, which had turned out to be five lives and injured many others, we added a psalm, specifically Psalm 20, Lam Natzeach Mizmor LeDavid, which we say most days during the week between Ashrei Unovol Etzion. Towards the end of that psalm, we say Elav Arechev VeElav Asusim VaNachnu B'Shem Elokeinu Nazkir, B'Shem Hashem Elokeinu Nazkir. The other nations fight with chariots and all kind of weapons, and we mention God's name. I don't know exactly how you want to interpret that. We use the power of prayer in order to help us in battle, etc., etc. In any event, the phrase that follows it is Hema Karuvena Falu. They are bowed down and fall, Va'anachnu Kamnu Va'nisodad, and we stand and remain upright. That is our prayer. The particular tune that you're going to hear maybe is a little peppier than you would think should go with that pasuk. The pasuk's words are hard to hear and understand because the accent is heavily Hasidish, but take my word for it. The words are Hema Karu V'Nafalu V'Anachnu Kamnu V'Nit Odad, sung by Shruli Ginsberg from his latest album.
La 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 הקורידון, ואנחנו גם נבנה את קורידון, 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 ואנחנו גם נבנה את קורידון.
You've been listening to Swirly Ginsburg with Haimu Haimu, or as we would say, Hema Hema. At the end of last week's Sedra, we see two of the main reasons that Yaakov is leaving Eretz Yisrael, both at the request of his father, one prompted by his mother. One of them is danger to him if he remains home. Esav wanted to kill Yaakov. Rivka says, gotta get out of here. She goes and gets Yitzchak to say that as well. The second motive is finding a suitable shiduch, a suitable bride. The third motive, which I don't know if it was right up front, because it seems that Yaakov went with a decent amount of belongings and money. He was robbed completely and left without a penny, so to speak, which means that his function in Chutz Laaretz over the subsequent years was to build a parnasa, a livelihood. And in that you find the three official real reasons that allow a person to temporarily, underline the word temporarily, italicize it, make it bold, or whatever you want to do with it, temporarily leave Eretz Yisrael. A person can do that if there is danger to his life if he remains, in order to find a bride, and in order to earn a livelihood. Parenthetically, I would add that learning Torah is a reason as well, but we can say that in Yaakov's case, there was plenty of Torah to be learned right there in Eretz Yisrael. But he leaves Eretz Yisrael because of danger. He leaves in order to find a wife, and he leaves for Parnassa purposes, at least after the fact. One of the things we have to learn from this is to watch Yaakov's hesitation, his stopping at the place, Vayifga Bamakom. He's about to make a monumental move out of Eretz Yisrael. His father Yitzchak has never left and never will leave Eretz Yisrael. Yaakov Avinu was born in Israel, and now he's about to leave, and he prays for divine guidance. God gives him permission, because there's an agenda here, and Yaakov comes back. To this very day, this is not an uncommon story. It does not mean that every detail of Yaakov's sojourn has to be simulated and emulated. The basic idea of being concerned about the maintenance of religious quality and standards, and people do point to the experience that Yaakov had in Laban's house. For example, they contrast the dream he had on his way out, one of angels and of God talking to him, to the much more materialistic dreams that he has later in the Sedra concerning how to get more goats and sheep as wages. And you could say, see what years out of Eretz Yisrael did to Yaakov. On the other hand, the Sedra brings him full circle back to Eretz Yisrael. He He leaves escorted by angels. He comes back to a group of angels, actually two groups, that will help him re-enter Eretz Yisrael, so to speak. And the Parsha itself deals with all the years in between and what happened to him and how his family grew, etc., etc. Let's listen to, this time, a Nigun on the Surly Ginsberg album. Nigun is a song without words, and then we'll continue with Parshat Vayetze. You're listening to Torah Tidbits Audio. We're talking about Parshat Vayetze, what I would call Yaakov's enrollment in the University of Hard Knocks, or the College of Hard Knocks, whatever it's called. Let's make a brief excursion into the halachic area here. We have a very famous statement from the Gemara that our prayers were established by the patriarchs, Tfilot Avot Tiknum. It's a whole discussion in the Gemara, but let's suffice it to say that Avraham, to Avraham is attributed Shacharit, to Yitzchak Mincha and to Yaakov Arvit Ma'ariv, the evening service. Specifically to Yaakov, we have the verse, Vayifga ba'makom vayolen sham kivo ha'shemesh. Yaakov encountered the place and slept there because the sun had set. The literal meaning, the plain, simple meaning is he left Beersheba on his way to Haran. He got to the place, which commentaries tell us was the site of the future Beit HaMikdash, the site of Akedat Yitzchak, a place known as a holy place, and he prayed for divine guidance. Specifically, the word Vayifga, and he encountered, based on a different verse in Tanakh, is associated with prayer. And because it's Kivo HaShemesh, because the sun had set, we associate this very first evening prayer with Yaakov Avinu, and we credit him with the invention of Arvit, so to speak. Does not mean that he prayed the evening service as we have it today, but we attribute the idea of praying in the evening to him. I want to review a few things for listeners who might not be up on these details. The evening service is really a fusion of two different mitzvot to perform: prayer and the recitation of the Shema. The Torah commands us elsewhere to recite Shema twice a day, b'shachbecha, at the time when people go to sleep, meaning nighttime, uvkumecha, when people arise, meaning the morning. So there's a Kriyat Shema in the morning, and there's a Kriyat Shema in the evening. Even though the average Siddur prayer book will begin with getting up in the morning and therefore have Shacharit first, technically, because of the concept of Vayihi Erev, Vayihi Voker, that Jewish days begin the night before. In English, we have a Thursday followed by Thursday night. In Jewish reckoning, Thursday night, what we call Thursday night in English, would really be Leil Shishi, the eve of the sixth day, which is Friday. So Friday evening, it's confusing if you say that in English, what you mean is the beginning of Shabbat, but technically Leil Shishi means Thursday night. Got that? In any event, therefore, the first mitzvah that we encounter is the evening prayer, and the Kriyat Shema of the night, and our sages fused them together by incorporating the fulfillment of the mitzvah of reciting Shema into the evening service. So the two main components of the evening service are the Shema with two brachot before and two brachot after, linked to the Amidah, which is the essential part of tefillah, prayer. Allow me to share with you an interesting comment brought down in the commentary of the Mishnah known as Kahati. The very, very first Mishnah, which means the beginning of the whole oral law, is Me'ematai Korin et Shema Ba'arvit. From when do we fulfill the mitzvah, are we able to fulfill the mitzvah, of reciting the evening Shema? The answer, Misha'a Shehakohanim Nichnasim Le'echol B'Trumatan. From the time that a Kohen who was Tameh during the day will be able first to eat of the sacred foods that are given to a Kohen, including challah and including truma. A Kohen, let's say, was either Tameh for 7 days, and we're talking about following the seventh day, or he was Tameh for a single day, ritually impure, then he is forbidden to eat sacred foods, which in the time of the temple would be common in the house of a Kohen, since some of the gifts of the kohuna are sacred. So he, for the last week or for the day, has been eating regular food that was bought in the local grocery store. But, let's say, hypothetically, that his wife makes this fantastic chocolate chip cookie using flour ground from wheat that was given as a gift to the Kohen as truma, and therefore he's not allowed to have that. She made the batch in the afternoon. Her children had cookies and milk from these fantastic chocolate chip cookies, and this Kohen is not allowed to eat them because he's tamei. What does he do? During the day he goes and immerses himself in a mikvah, and then he waits out the day until stars out, tzeta kochavim. That's the first time he's allowed to eat truma after his period of being tamei, and that is the first time we're allowed to say kriyat shema. So, Kahati quotes Rav Unterman Zal, who was a previous chief rabbi, who used to give shiurim in Mishnayot, and he said, Rav Unterman explained that the choice, let's go back a step. The commentaries ask, why not say, when can you say the Shema? From stars out. What does it have to say from the time that the Kohanim begin to eat their truma? Because then you'll have a question, when is that? The answer is, Tzeta Kochavim, stars out. So say so. So the commentaries say that this was the style of the Mishnah to bring in another teaching, sort of inter alia, even though the topic is Kriyat Shema, and the topic will lead to an understanding of when stars out is. You want to add something, as if to say, by the way, Kohanim are allowed to begin eating after a period of being ritually impure from the same time stars out. Rav Unterman gives it a nice twist. He said, using the image of a Kohen coming in to eat truma, and back to my example of the knockout chocolate chip cookies, then we're talking not just about a technical act. I look at my watch, 4:32, 7:55, you know, whatever it is, 6:12 is Tzeta Kochavim. I'm hungry, okay, I could eat, says the Kohen. No, it's more than that. We're talking about doing something with enthusiasm. When this Kohen that I described in the hypothetical is counting down the minutes until he will be able to eat the most delicious chocolate chip cookies in the world, says Rav Unterman, that is the enthusiasm which we have to the reciting of Kriyat Shema at night and to the davening of Ma'ariv. Now, especially Arvit, it's a little tricky. Let's take as an example these days now during the winter. 5 o'clock in the evening in Jerusalem, many people are already davening Ma'ariv. Till when can you daven Ma'ariv? Till 5:30, 6 o'clock the next morning. That's more than 12-hour period you're able to daven Ma'ariv and technically fulfill the mitzvah of Kriyat Shema any time during those 12 hours. But our general approach to mitzvot is zrizim makdimim l'mitzvah. Enthusiastic people will do the mitzvot when they first are able to do it and not let it hang around. So we say, are you the type of person who will daven Ma'ariv at 5 o'clock because that's the earliest time you could daven? Or do you wait until you get home from work and then maybe have some supper and then maybe relax a little and watch the news on television and read the newspaper and play with your kids and then it's 10 o'clock, it's 10:30, it's 11 o'clock and you'll daven Ma'ariv? Not enthusiastic. We're talking about a new day. Once the sun sets and the stars come out, you've got a new day in front of you. What do you do with your new day? The first thing you should do with your new day is pray the evening service, Daven Ma'ariv, and fulfill the Torah's mitzvah to recite the Shema at nighttime. That's the enthusiasm which we should show, and Rav Unterman says, just picture in your mind this Kohen who has patiently waited until 5 o'clock to be able to have his wife's chocolate chip cookies, and he does not want to say, oh, you know, I'll do other things and I'll get to it at 11 o'clock. We shouldn't do that with Ma'ariv. Let's have a listen to a song called Yatzliach. It comes from the third pasuk in the beginning of Tehillim, Tehillim Aleph Pasuk Gimel. The pasuk is V'haya ke'etz shatul al palge mayim asher piriyo yitain be'ito v'alehu lo yibol v'chol asher ya'aseh yatzliach. And the song goes like this. There's an interesting contrast we should be aware of. Avraham Avinu is first introduced to us at the very end of Parshat Noach. Lech Lecha and Vayera and Chayesara are the sedras that chronicle Avraham and Sarah's life. And finally, Yitzchak Avinu comes on the scene. Not just at the end of Chayesara, he's been there before, but it's the story of Avram and Sarah and their long-awaited son, Yitzchak. And then Parshat Toldot has the unfolding story of the long period that Yitzchak and Rivka did not have a child, and then the birth of Esav and Yaakov, and all of the drama that came from that. But it focuses Yitzchak, Yaakov. And now, in Parshat Vayetze, we get into a fast-forward at a certain point, which really spins your head. It starts out slow. Yaakov gets to the place. He asks the shepherds what's doing. Here comes Rachel. He falls in love with Rachel, and he wants to marry her. And Lavan's enthusiastic response is, well, you know, why not? Better I give her to you than somebody else. I always wondered about that kind of enthusiasm from Lavan. One way or the other, there's the deception, and he's married to Leah, and then another 7 years he works for Rachel, and then within a very, very short span, and it's obviously done on purpose, we have the births of Yaakov's children, the tribes of Israel. You have God sees that Leah was the less favored wife, Vayiftach et Rachmah, Virachel Akara. God opens up Leah's womb, and Rachel remains barren. Starting with Pusuk 32 in chapter 29, look at how fast it goes. Leah becomes pregnant, she gives birth to a son, she calls him Reuven and a reason. She gets pregnant again, and she gives birth to a son, and she has a reason. That attaches, and she calls his name Shimon. She gets pregnant again, and she gives birth to a son, and she says, this time, dot, 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 therefore they called his name Levi. She gets pregnant again, and gives birth to Yehuda, each name accompanied by a reason of the etymology of the name. That's four psukim, four children. Then Rachel sees that she's not giving birth, and she's jealous of her sister, and she complains to Yaakov, and he speaks harshly to her, and then she says, no, no, I'm not complaining per se, I want you to take my handmaiden Bilhah, have a child with her, and that will be considered my child. Apparently that was the style in the olden times. So he does, she becomes pregnant, gives birth to a son. Rachel names him Dan. She gets pregnant again. Rachel names the second child Naphtali. Then Leah sees that she stopped giving birth, so she says to Yaakov, take my handmaiden Zilpah, and we'll have more children from her. And she becomes pregnant, and Leah names the child Gad, and she becomes pregnant again and names the other one Asher. And then the story with the Dudaim of Reuven, the mandrakes, the fertility herb that Rachel takes, and Leah gets pregnant again, and she names the kid Yisachar, and gets pregnant again, and names the kid Zvulun, and gets pregnant again, and names the child Dina, except it doesn't say get pregnant again, and I'll talk about that in a moment. Then, finally, God remembers Rachel, so to speak. She becomes pregnant and gives birth to a son, who she names Yosef. Within a very short number of psukim, in rapid-fire succession, Yaakov Avinu goes from having no children, he now has 11 of his 12 sons and his daughter Dina. I'm just making that as an observation, but let's now take an interesting look at one aspect of this. The lead tidbit in the hard copy of Torah Tidbits this week contains a quote from Bill Cosby's routine, Noah and the Lord. The quote is, you know I don't work like that. It's one of the lines that I found extremely profound from what is essentially a comedy routine. Funny thing is that my first introduction to Noah and the Lord by Bill Cosby was not by Bill Cosby at all, but was by two kids in Bnei Akiva who put it on as a skit, and I thought they had written it. And then later I found out that it was a well-known comedy routine by Bill Cosby. In any event, if you know it, fine. If you don't, I will give you the relevant piece of it. Noah has succeeded in this very difficult task of building an ark and taking the ridicule of the neighbors and gathering two of every animal. And he hears the booming voice of the Lord once again calling to him and says the equivalent of, what do you want this time? And the Lord says, I want you to take out one hippopotamus and bring in another. What do you want me to do a stupid thing like that for? Says an exasperated Noah. Because they're both male. So change one of them, is what Noah says. And God's answer is, you know I don't work like that. Now, why do I bring it up in Parshat Vayetze? We have commentaries, Rashi included and many, many others, who remark about the following. Leah gets pregnant and gives birth. Leah gets pregnant and gives birth. Repeatedly it says, and she gets pregnant and gives birth, both with Leah and with Bilhah and Zilpah and with Rachel. The one time it does not mention being pregnant is this pasuk, V'achar Yolda Bat, and afterwards she gave birth to a girl, V'atikra et Shma Dina, and she called her name Dina. So the commentaries say, it doesn't mention being pregnant, and they tell us the following. Leah was pregnant again. She saw with Ruach HaKodesh, divine insight, we'll say, that she was destined to have a seventh child, a seventh son to Yaakov. In other words, she was carrying Yosef. She prayed to God that she should not be the cause of embarrassing her sister, shaming her sister Rachel, because she knew from that same divine insight that Yaakov was to have 12 children, and she did the math. She already had 6 sons. Bilhah had 2, and Zilpah had 2, makes 10. If Rachel has the other 2, at least she would not have fewer sons than the Shvachot, Bilhah and Zilpah. So she prays to God, and God rewards her prayer, answers her prayer, and changes the fetus to a female, who becomes Dina. Now, there are commentaries who try to wiggle their way out of it and say that it was early in the pregnancy, until 40 days, the sex of the offspring is not fixed yet, and therefore it was okay for Leah to pray that. Others point to the halacha to say this was called a tfilat shav, a wasted prayer. In other words, when a man's wife is pregnant, he should not pray that it should be a boy, because it either is or it isn't. He could pray that the baby be healthy, and that's what he should pray, because that is not yet determined. But whether it's a boy or a girl is already determined, and therefore it's a wasted prayer. However, they point to this prayer of Leah as the exception that proved the rule. Because, back to Bill Cosby's routine, when God says, you know I don't work like that, we can qualify that by saying, you know I don't usually work like that. You want a female instead of a male? Take out the male hippopotamus and bring in a female hippopotamus. That's the normal way of nature. There are males and there are females. What Leah was asking was something above nature. And she was answered because of her pure motives in not shaming Rachel. And therefore this became an exception to the rule. I heard a shiur once on surrogate motherhood when a woman conceives but is not able to carry a baby to term, where her fertilized egg and developing embryo is transplanted into another mother's womb to be carried for the months of pregnancy and give birth. The halachic issues include a very serious question as to who is considered the real mother. And the lecture included reference to this episode with Leah, and said if Leah was carrying Yosef and it switched to Dina and she gave birth to a girl, then she is identified as the mother of the girl. And Rachel, if she was not carrying originally Yosef but later carried and gave birth to him, then he is considered to be her son. However, the person giving the shiur said you cannot fix halacha based on these medrashim. In other words, take it for what it says, and it is a demonstration of Leah's sincere desire not to shame Rachel, as Rachel selflessly gave her special simanim over to Leah so that Leah should not have to end up with Esav. And what we see is that these two sisters really, really loved each other. Now, on that note, we can take it one sad step further. A rivalry developed, unavoidable, between Rachel and Leah, It translated in the next generation in devastating proportions. The whole business with Yosef and his brothers was a continuation and a reflection of the rivalry between Leah and Rachel. Let me interject on this point a little bit of a problem. If we read the stories in the book of Bereshit, and we identify them and personify them, and see them through glasses of our own society and our own time, then we see it more like a soap opera, and there are problems with that, because there's definitely a layer and a level that we have to acknowledge that we're talking about the Avot and Imahot, the matriarchs and patriarchs, who do not fit the standards of our own society. If you look at it just that way, then you've got tough lives and wrong decisions that were made in addition to good decisions, and that's not necessarily a bad way to see it, because as I've said many times, our learning from the deeds of others should always be on two different tracks. Learn the good things and emulate them, and learn from the bad things not to emulate them. I think mathematically it's sort of like absolute value. The absolute value of 10 is 10. The absolute value of minus 10 is also 10. If you can convert a minus 10 episode into an absolute value of 10 and learn a valuable lesson from it in a positive way, then we are truly able to learn properly from the good and the bad as well, and I think that's what we have to do. What I said about the rivalry, there was even a rivalry on the Rachel and Leah level, although there was tremendous love and sacrifice that each demonstrated. But when it came down to the next generation, it was Reuven, Shimon, Levi, and Yehuda mostly, who had a tremendous resentment, which was really motivated, at least initiated, by their concern for their mother's honor. This rivalry reverberates through Jewish history, especially when the kingdoms split into Ephraim representing Yosef and Yehuda representing Leah's children. And it just goes on and on. We can translate that into our own times, although it's only in a figurative way, into the various rivalries between different groups of Jews, be they Ashkenazim and Sfardim, or national religious Zionists and Haredim, and secular and religious, all kind of divisions. Divisions are not necessarily healthy. Let me finish with a totally unrelated Dvar Torah. I was flipping through the back pages of a Siddur last week, and I came across a chart of priorities for Aliyot on Shabbat morning, where a Yortzeit, a Bar Mitzvah, an Ufruf, who has priority? Father of a boy, father of a girl, etc., etc. Not going to go into that now. What I found on that same chart was a very interesting little detail. If there are two men, each has Yortzeit for his father, and you only have one Aliyah to give him, and one of the men is a Talmud Chacham, a Torah scholar, and the other is an Am Ha'aretz, a plain, simple, uneducated Jew, the Aliyah goes to the Am Ha'aretz, to the uneducated Jew, which raised my eyebrow when I first saw it, but it continues and gives the reason. The reason is that a Talmud Chacham, a Torah scholar, has other ways of doing an Ilui Neshama for his father on the Yortzeit. Ilui Neshama is that which elevates the soul of the departed because of the merit of the son, of the child. And since he can learn Mishnayot or give a Shiur or a Dvar Torah, and that will serve his father's memory, the Am Haaretz, who's not really capable of doing anything other than getting an aliyah in shul, he has priority for that aliyah. Think about it. It's an interesting point to ponder. On that note, let me wish everyone a Shabbat Shalom, and let's finish with a song. This is an oldie but goodie. The words come from Birkat HaMazon for Shabbat. Harachaman hu yanchilenu yom shekulo Shabbat u'menucha l'chaye olamim. The song, I think, was originally a Baruch Chait song done by the rabbi's sons. This is from an album called Encore, which I think is part of the original, or uses the original tracks. Here it is, Harachaman, Lehishtamea.
Shabbos Menucha, Orachamon, Uyanchileinu, Yom Shekulo Shabbos Menucha. Yom Shekulo Shabbos Menucha, Lechaye Lechaye Olamim. Yom Shekulo Shabbos Menucha, Lechaye Olamim. Yom shekulo shabbos menucha, orachamon, uyanchileinu. Yom shekulo shabbos menucha.
I 10,000 years will give you such a crick in the neck. Hang on a second. Wow! Does it feel good to be out of there? I'm telling you, nice to be back, ladies and gentlemen. Hi, where are you from? What's your name?
Meep, meep. Meep, meep.